All that we've been told is that your abilities will be needed in the future when all electromagnetic communications will be rendered useless. How will this happen? I asked. Again, there are things that you have no need to know at this point, and that is one of them. To tell you the truth, I do not know either. I have my suspicions, which I am sure you will have as time goes on as well. I will be your PPD point of contact during your stay here in Maryland. It is probably obvious, but I must address it anyway. You are not authorized to speak to anyone about PPD unless I direct you to do so. You will be going through a highly specialized school while you are here. This school is designed to teach you how to recognize and uncover auric abilities. You will see another student during your classroom time, as there are two of you here at present. Neither of you may speak to one another. Your transportation to and from the school will be provided. You will meet a blue van outside your hotel after your ELINT classes break for the day. You will be expected to be down at the van exactly 45 minutes from the time you arrive back to your room from your ELINT class. This will give you enough time to do any necessary tasks before departing for your PPD classes. Don't worry, we'll go over most of this again tomorrow. Do you have any other questions for me so far, Sergeant Sherman? I had plenty of questions, but all I could say was, not right now, sir. Captain White went on as if reading from a manual. I realize this has been quite a shock, and you may not even believe what I am telling you right now, but I assure you, Sergeant Sherman, this is not a dream. The captain understood exactly what I was thinking. I was grasping for some sort of explanation. Even though I knew Captain White was telling me the truth, I kept expecting this to turn out to be an elaborate joke. Perhaps they were initiating my arrival to the ELINT school. I expected some joker to jump out of a closet laughing and pointing at me as if I were the biggest fool in the world for falling for this alien thing. Yet I couldn't dispute what was being told to me. Everything was too elaborate, and the captain too convincing. This was real. When you get back to your hotel, all kinds of questions are going to come to you. Please make a mental note of them. I say mental note because you are not to write anything down at all concerning this subject. We're seeing each other again tomorrow for your school indoctrination. You will be able to ask any follow-up questions at that time. Until then, you understand that you are not allowed to speak about this to anyone, correct? The military training in me stepped up to the vocal cords and announced automatically, "Yes, sir." Well, I think you've probably earned some much-needed rest. You look pretty worn out. I'll give you a call tomorrow to set up a time to meet at the same entrance we met at today. Captain White started to rise and I followed his lead. Of course I had more questions, but he appeared to have stopped taking them. As I stepped out of the NSA building into the sunny but cold Maryland winter air, I realized everything that had been important to me before I stepped into this building earlier today had all of a sudden changed. I don't remember the long walk back to my car. My mind was racing and churning over and over. There was absolutely life elsewhere. No doubt, not fiction, they actually existed. I had always believed in the possibility of life elsewhere, but it was difficult to comprehend. Even as I now knew, on a conscious level, that aliens existed, I still found myself resorting to rationalization. I was trying to deny the truth because it didn't fit what I always thought was real. My previous beliefs about extraterrestrial life were always based on a distant possibility. Now that I was confronted with the reality of it head-on, my mind had a hard time believing. I drove back to the hotel. During the 15-minute trip, I started becoming slightly paranoid. Every car I passed or that passed me, in my overly heightened sense of awareness, could have been someone following me to make sure I didn't tell anyone that aliens existed. Of course, that was ludicrous. What if I did tell someone? Would I be found dead behind a country barn 50 miles from civilization? I began to wonder how they kept people who knew about this program from telling someone. I didn't intend to find out, that was for sure. ULL just need to sign these forms so that the guard can issue you your restricted area badge. My clearances had arrived. I posed for a picture, signed the badge and waited for the guard to laminate it and attach a chain to it. While we waited, the captain was uncomfortably silent. I stole glances of him out of the corner of my eye. He seemed too calm for someone who knew aliens existed. I wasn't sure how you were supposed to act, but calm didn't seem to fit. This was all so new to me and I constantly felt nervous. Sergeant Sherman, the rent-a-cop guard called out, interrupting my thoughts about the captain. I went up to the counter to retrieve my new, freshly laminated restricted area badge. Here is your PIN, Sergeant Sherman. Just swipe your card through the card reader, enter your PIN then press the pound key. You should get a green light and hear a click from the door or turnstile. Back at the hotel, as I lay in bed, all these questions began to surface. The main one being, if there was life elsewhere then where did God fit into the picture? Was God a fictional entity that we humans had dreamed up in order to make sense of our lives? There had to be a mastermind that made order out of chaos. Were the aliens God? I drifted off to sleep questioning my own religious beliefs and wondering if I would ever get any answers. The phone rang, awakening me once again. I knew it would be Captain White, so I rushed to answer it. "Hello," I said a little too excitedly, like a kid answering the phone when he knew Santa would be calling. "Good morning, Sergeant Sherman," I heard the efficient voice of Captain White quickly say. "Meet me at the same entrance at 090 hours." "Yes, sir. I'll be there." "Do I need to bring anything?" "No. I'll see you at 9. As I hung up the phone it occurred to me this wasn't a dream. I sat on the edge of the bed, rubbing my eyes, as the questions I had gone to sleep thinking about came rushing back to me. I'd have to make a mental note of them like the captain said. The captain was already at the visitor's center when I got there. He met me with a smile which set aside my fear that he was mad because I was late. This was the same system we had at my own base, so I wasn't paying much attention to the guard. My mind had too many other things to think about than to listen to the rent-a-cop. In the midst of my mental wanderings I noticed the guard had stopped talking to me, so I took that as my cue. "Thank you," I said, even though I hadn't paid much attention to his instructions. "All set?" the captain asked. "I guess so," I answered. The captain led me out the visitor center's doors. But instead of turning right to go through the building's security turnstiles he turned left and headed for the doors that led outside. I almost questioned where he was going but consciously bit my tongue instead and continued to follow behind. Waiting for us in front of the building in a no parking zone was a blue Air Force van. My heart began to beat faster. My internal safety mechanisms were sounding. Where were they taking me? More importantly, would I return? Those were the two immediate concerns paramount in my mind as I climbed into the van ahead of the captain. I was sitting in a van with blackout windows, traveling to an unknown location. When it hit me like a ton of bricks, my life was never going to be the same again. I was right. Intuitive communicator. The van that I would end up spending a lot of time in over the next few months was interesting. You could not see anything through the windows, either looking inside or looking out. Because the cab part of the van where the driver sat was blocked from view as well, I never once was able to get a good look at the person driving the van. This was always amusing to me and I even had a nickname for him, Casper the Friendly Van Driver. Not that I could share my sense of humor with anyone, as I was never able to talk to the driver nor anyone else while I was there except Captain White. And after our initial meetings I didn't see him too often. I asked Captain White where we were going a few minutes after we had boarded the van. The actual location of the site is not important. You'll always be picked up by this van at your hotel and taken to school every day. More silence. I wanted to know so much, but when was the proper time to ask questions? The van appeared to be coming to a final stop but not quite. It crept forward for a few more seconds, went over a few bumps, then came to a halt. I could tell this was our destination because I heard the driver shift the transmission into park. A few seconds later the engine stopped. I heard the thunk of the locks unlocking and the captain opened the sliding door to the van and climbed out. I climbed out after him. I didn't look around too much because I didn't want to appear nosy. There was no time to look around anyway as we headed straight for a metal door along the wall in front of us. I was able to notice we were in a concrete room the size of an oversized four-car garage. The room had no exterior light sources, no windows at all. The ceiling looked to be about 12 to 14 feet high. The metal door we headed for was about 10 feet from the van. My mind was racing. Was I going to see an alien? There were no card readers at the metal door we approached. Instead, the captain held his hand up to a metal hand-shaped plate mounted on the wall to the left of the door. Embedded into the ends of each metal finger were many glass windows. During the many times I entered this store, I assumed the metal hand was a device to read a person's fingerprints through the little glass windows at the fingertips. I gave some thought to the possibility that it could have been reading my heat signature as well. I never knew for sure. What I did know was that the security measures were advanced beyond any that I had seen before or have seen since. After the captain placed his hand on the metal hand-shaped plate, I could hear the familiar click signaling that the door could be opened. We stepped into a vestibule area, similar in size to the vestibule outside the captain's office. He placed his forehead on a black visor of the retina scanner mounted above a small glass window on the left wall. I heard a beep, then the captain placed his hand up to another metal hand-shaped plate, this time for the right hand, on the same wall to the lower right of the retina scanner visor. This time the door in front of us clicked. The captain pulled the door open. I was surprised to see that we were stepping into an elevator. Interestingly, the door opened directly into the elevator, no other doors, sliding or otherwise. I remember wondering how they had all this machinery serviced. I couldn't help but picture little aliens running around with tool belts on. Standing there in the elevator, I could see there was only one button and a little handle off to the right of the button. There were no markings on anything. I assumed there was only one button because there was only one choice of movement, up if you were at the bottom and down if you were at the top. As the elevator moved, I could tell it was moving down. It took 15 seconds or so to arrive at its destination. On the way down, the captain turned to face the opposite wall of the elevator. I took this to mean that we would be exiting the elevator in the opposite direction we had entered. Indeed, as we came to a halt, double doors opened in front of us. The room we stepped out of the elevator into was approximately 25 feet by 15 feet. Straight ahead on the other side of the room, facing us, was a glass window that appeared to be as black as the windows in the van. The window was big, taking up most of the wall it occupied. I could see the captain and me reflected in it as we stepped out of the elevator. On the left and right walls were identical workstations. To the immediate right of the workstation against the left wall was a door, narrower than a normal door would be. Two large computer monitors and a standard keyboard were at each workstation. I remember being impressed by the size of the computer monitor's screens. They were at least 26 inches measured diagonally, if not more. The only other furnishings were two chairs at the workstations and a table in the middle of the room. On the table was a pitcher of water, two glasses, and a plate with two pills on it. Captain White motioned for me to pull up to the table with one of the chairs. The captain sat at the head of the table and placed his briefcase down in front of him. "This one take long, Sergeant Sherman. We just need to get some papers signed and go over some security issues." "Okay," I said. "You are already aware of the Alien Project. There are other programs that ULL become involved with that service cover all black missions. The Coven missions are designed to do just that, cover the existence of the alien program." It was at this time I asked the obvious question anyone would ask: why hide the alien program from the public to begin with? "That's a good question, Sergeant Sherman. My guess is that the information being kept from the public, if released, would create instability to world markets and the global equilibrium of power that is so unstable anyway. I had read that this was one of the reasons the government kept alien information a secret. It seemed too much of a canned answer to me. Indeed, he said it like he had memorized the answer. The captain went on. I am sure it is not so much the specific knowledge that aliens exist that is the problem, it is more like the information that we have gained from communicating with them that would create havoc if released. That seems a bit more believable, I thought to myself. Although, the mere fact that there is intelligent life other than us in the universe would most likely put a strain on the world's religions, which would have a domino effect in global relations. Back to the point though, I am not sure exactly why this information has not been released, but I do know that it is not our place to share it with anyone. This is the reason PPD has been hidden behind other classified projects. I am sure you've heard of black projects. The press loves to report on the black budget. Yes, I've heard about them, I answered. These are actual projects that are hidden from the general public because of national security reasons. Of course, it wouldn't do any harm if the average American knew this stuff. But as we know, if Mr. Joe Public has access to information, then so do any potential enemies who may use the information against us. There are many examples of black projects within the US military. You will be told about the specific projects you will be working with when you have a need to know in the future. There will be no need to indoctrinate you into the black project here. Any questions before we go any further? No, I said, as I sat back for my official PPD indoctrination. After I had signed numerous forms promising I would not divulge any classified information for the next 75 years, or some ridiculous number, the captain went on with my indoctrination. As I said yesterday, PPD had its beginnings in 1960. The personnel in charge of the project, at the time, tried to figure out a better way to keep the program from the eyes of the increasingly aware public. Brute force and manipulation was intimidating but not an effective long-term solution. In order to protect any future information leaks, they instituted what they called the onion effect. I was slightly confused by this time, so I asked, "When you say brute force and manipulation, what do you mean exactly? In what context are you talking about?" The personnel working with alien projects at the time were simply told not to tell any unauthorized person about anything they knew or they, a friend, or a family member would meet with an unfortunate situation. Of course, fear is a prime motivator but not the most effective. They still had people stealing documents with classified markings all over them as proof to others about what was going on. In order to hide information effectively back then, it took a great deal of resources and manpower to oversee everyone involved with alien programs. So when PPD was first formed, it was the model for the new onion effect. It was also around this time period that a new black project was just getting started, so they decided to hide the newly formed PPD behind this new black project to keep curious congressmen and other nosy officials away. How the onion effect works is similar to the actual layers of an onion. An onion has many different layers. So does the military. On the outside of the military onion, the side everyone can see, is the unclassified layer. This is the layer that is typically portrayed to the public and may or may not have any bearing on the true mission of the organization, base or installation. At most government locations, the unclassified publicized mission of the base is perfectly accurate, and there is truly nothing to hide. But this is not true of every location. The next layer we uncover on our way to the center of the onion is called the for official use only, FUO, layer, or level 5. FUO is mostly a formal way of keeping what is essentially unclassified information from being disseminated indiscriminately. If several FUO bits of information were to be pieced together to form a more classified picture, the release of that information could inadvertently be as damaging as the release of a higher level of classified information. The next layer on the classified journey is secret, or level 4. The unauthorized release of secret information and above has the potential of causing serious damage to national security. The next layer is Top Secret, TS, or Level 3. Within the TS category there are code words that compartmentalize the release of information even further. These code words are used to protect many missions, including the ones referred to as black missions. Black missions, which we call Level 2, are what the alien projects are effectively hidden behind. The existence of black missions is only known by a handful of congressmen and the president. These black missions are the last line of defense for the alien projects. Wherever an alien project is located, there must be a black mission to cover its existence from prying eyes. It creates a highly sophisticated shield designed to mask the gray project's existence from high-level officials who have no need to know. Otherwise, the alien project would eventually come under scrutiny by someone within official channels. As it stands under the current system, if a nosy congressman starts looking where he has no need to know, he can be briefed on the black mission, be made to feel important and thereby squelching any further digging. It's an extremely effective method of hiding alien missions and is the reason they have been hidden so effectively for so long. Last, but not least, on the trip through the onion, we come to the alien missions or Level 1, referred to as gray matter or slant missions. The center of the onion always contains the alien project. Not even the commander of a site is normally aware of the alien project residing beneath his nose. Anyone who is or has been part of an alien project is considered to be first level, or Level 1 personnel. Personnel who serve in a support function to the first level are considered second level and are unaware of the link between their jobs and the alien project they are covering for. They work with the cover or black missions. In addition, the existence of the entire level system is only known by first level people. It gets even more complicated. Within Level 1 there are separate and distinct categories called steps which directly correspond with your need to know. As he was explaining this onion effect, I remember being fascinated by the ingenuity of the system. It was obviously very effective in preventing information from being revealed. Captain White finished explaining the onion effect. "Any questions, Sergeant Sherman?" he asked. "Yes, sir," I replied. "You allude to the fact that there is more than one alien mission, is this true?" "I only refer to the being more than one because I assume there are several. I am not personally aware of any others, but since we have been in contact with them since 1947, I can only assume there are now and have been others in the past. I thought that was a logical assumption. Another question I've been meaning to ask is, how have they been communicating with us since 1947 if you've only recently been able to get people who can communicate with them? I am a little confused about that."
"That's a good question, Sergeant Sherman. Unfortunately, I don't know the answer. I can only venture to guess that we only have the ability to communicate with them now through traditional electromagnetic means.
I am not sure."
"I see. Now let us talk about your school, Sergeant Sherman," the captain said, moving on to another subject. "When the van lets you off upstairs, you'll do exactly what we just did to get down here. On the way out today, we'll enter your identification parameters into the system. When you get down here, come straight to the table and take two of these pills using this water, then sit down at your workstation, put on these headphones and await further instructions from your instructor. It's as simple as that." Having heard nothing up to this point about taking any pills, I was understandably alarmed. "Why do I have to take these pills? What are they for?" I asked, somewhat defensively.
"They are to facilitate your abilities. They're quite harmless," the captain said nonchalantly. Of course I wasn't taking it so lightly, so I asked again. "But what are they?"
"To tell you the truth, I'm not sure. But you will have to take them to help you with your schooling," he said. I didn't like the idea of eating an unknown substance, but I reluctantly agreed with a passive nod of my head. The captain went on, "After you place your headphones on, you'll hear all your instructions through them. If you need to ask a question of your instructor, there will be a box to type the question out on your screen. Your instructor will tell you about this during your first lesson. That's it. Any questions?"
I had none. I was too overwhelmed once again. This was becoming a prevalent feeling. The captain went on. As I mentioned yesterday, there will be another student learning at the other workstation. You will work at this one. He pointed to the workstation on the left wall. You will see each other every day, but you may not talk to one another at all. It's imperative that you understand this. Do you understand?
Yes, I said. I wondered what the big deal was though. On the way out of the classroom, we stopped in the vestibule upstairs before exiting the metal door to the waiting van. The captain entered a number on a numerical touchpad mounted on the wall, which I had not seen when we came in. After entering a number, he told me to place my hand on the metal hand-shaped plate. A tone sounded. He punched a number into the keypad once again, and told me to place my forehead on the visor, look straight ahead and hold still. I did so. We heard a tone once again signaling that my parameters had been successfully entered. We stepped out of the vestibule back into the garage. The captain instructed me to place my hand on the other metal-shaped hand outside the door. We verified this parameter was entered correctly, then headed for the blue van parked in front of us. I was now officially entered into the system and was able to enter the vestibule and elevator unescorted. There was no turning back now, assuming of course I had that choice to begin with. The school my ELINT classes began without a hitch. The ELINT school was held at one of the NZS office complexes just north of Fort Meade called the FANX, pronounced FANX. It was a challenge to go to my day classes and be expected to attend my night classes for PPD. By the end of the first month I was exhausted. The exhaustion I felt wasn't so much a physical exhaustion, as it was a mental. Both classes were mentally challenging, but the PPD classes were challenging on a different level. A level I wasn't even aware existed prior to PPD school. School for PPD started the same day as my ELINT classes. I met the van after my ELINT classes had ended for the day, as instructed. As soon as I entered the van and sat down, the doors locked, presumably under the control of the driver. We drove for about a half an hour. A pattern never seemed to develop in the turns and stops during the trip, which prevented me from mentally mapping where I was being taken. Right before the final stop, we went through what would become a familiar ritual of movements. A slowdown, the front axle going over a slight bump, then the back, the driver placing the engine in park, and the thunk of the doors unlocking about 10 seconds after the last bump. During this first day, the garage appeared much as it did before. Absent of supervision, I looked around a bit more. The walls were black. I looked at the doors that the van would have come through. I didn't see any evidence of sunlight coming through the cracks around the doors. Although most days it was dark by the time I arrived at PPD school, this first day I left the hotel just before dusk. The entire time I attended PPD classes, I never once saw any sunlight come into this room where the van would park. I came to the conclusion that the building we were in was not out in the open, but perhaps underground or hidden within a bunker of some sort. I placed my hand against the metal plate, heard the click, opened the door and entered the vestibule. Making sure the door was shut behind me, I went to the left wall and placed my forehead on the visor. After a few seconds I heard a tone which was my cue to place my hand against the metal plate once again. I entered the elevator, pushed the one button and down I went. After coming to a halt, the elevator doors opened and I stepped out into the room. The first thing I saw was the pitcher of water on the table, which reminded me what the captain had told me about the water and the pills. I went to the table, poured a glass of water, grabbed two of the four pills sitting in the plate and popped them in my mouth and drank the water to wash them down. I figured the other pills were for the other student scheduled to attend classes at the same time. As soon as I sat down to my workstation, the elevator doors slid open. I jumped slightly, startled by the unexpected motion and noise. Out of the elevator stepped my classmate, whom I never once said a word to during the entire length of our class together. I didn't know his name, where he was from or anything else about him. We simply nodded to one another and he sat down. After taking his pills, he slid over to his workstation. He appeared to be a bit more familiar with things than I. He moved with the confidence that only familiarity brings. He put his headphones on, which reminded me that I needed to do the same.